Hello, listeners, and welcome to Sportspiel, the podcast with a more stable structure than the Saudi Arabian defensive line. Joining me, Alistair Hooper, as ever, to discuss all things sport, is Mr. Will Moulton.
Good morning. How bad was that Saudi Arabian defence?
It's pretty pitiful. 5-0 in the opening game against Russia. Ouch.
It was an appalling game of football, though, to be honest. All Saudi Arabia did was kick it backwards, and all Russia did was lump it forwards and score. I mean, the fourth goal by Cheryshev with the outside of the foot was a sweet strike, but that came about from a stupid defensive error. The fifth goal was a good free kick, but I don't know what the keeper was doing. He just decided to soar through the air about 6 seconds after he should have done.
I think I asked what the goalkeeper was doing several times during that match.
It wasn't a good advert for football.
Not at all. But anyway, how are you? How have you been these last couple of weeks since we last did an episode?
Everything's good. The World Cup has kicked off. Football fever has hit the nation to a point. Hopefully it'll properly kick off when England play Tunisia on Monday.
Yeah, I'd say it's hit the nation.
But at least we've had one good game so far.
Yes, Spain-Portugal was very, snorter. Very good. Which I missed 85 minutes of. So I saw the last 5 minutes.
Still saw that free kick though?
Still saw. I came in the door and I saw the free kick and I was like, oh my God. And then realised what I just missed and was slightly annoyed. But hey, moving on, and if you are a new listener to the podcast, this is the bit where we explain just how it works. The first section of every Sportspiel episode is the discussion section where myself and Will go through some of the big sports topics currently rearing their heads. Today we will discuss Lizzie Deignan's comments regarding fellow cyclist Chris Froome on anti-doping before we inevitably chat about the FIFA World Cup in Russia as the whole world goes football crazy with the first match, of course, kicking off on Thursday. The second part of every episode is our feature interview section where myself or Will chat in depth with a star from the sporting world. And we're delighted to say that on this show we have the fantastic Beth Dobbin, who, at the start of this month, broke a 34-year-old record as she became the fastest Scottish 200-metre sprinter. In our chat, we obviously talk about that achievement, missing out on the Commonwealth by 1/100th of a second, and we also talk about how she has coped with and managed her epilepsy. All that and more on this episode of Sportspiel. Well then, let us slipstream our way into the handlebar two-wheeled chaos that is the sport of cycling. In May, 33-year-old Chris Froome became the first Briton to win the Giro d'Italia, which completed a Grand Tour hat-trick, following his Vuelta a España victory and also his fourth Tour de France win in 2017. Surely, these are results that will put him on a pedestal where he is granted legendary status as a sportsman. But not quite. As we have alluded to before, Froome hasn't exactly captured the public's imagination for various reasons, but perhaps the biggest of these issues is doping. He was found to have doubled the allowed level of a legal asthma drug in his urine after a test at the Vuelta, which he of course won, and the anti-doping case is still ongoing. However, this week, Lizzie Deignan, herself a former world champion, came out and said that he had been unfairly treated in his anti-doping case, and his reputation will always be tarnished. Speaking on Ola Shenoy's podcast, When Ola Met, she said, "Unfortunately for Chris, his reputation is tarnished and will be forever. Whether he is innocent or not, it's kind of irrelevant to some people at this stage. A leak in a legal process should never happen." So there's obviously lots of info to take in there, so I will begin simply by asking, is Chris Froome being treated unfairly by us, the public?
Yes. As we've discussed before, no one ever really talks about just what it's done for cycling, which is frankly unrivaled, certainly in this country and pretty much across the world. You know, he's got the hat trick, the three big tour victories, the first Brit to ever win the Giro d'Italia last month, and yet when he did it, there was so little coverage of it. Whereas in the build up to it, when Simon Yates was in the lead, there was so much coverage. Everyone's like, oh, we've got a new cyclist, you know, coming through, new hope. He lost the lead. Froome completed the most remarkable of comebacks.
It's not the fact that he won it, it's the way he won it as well.
He was nowhere, and it was this incredible comeback in the back end of the tour. But yet, as soon as he took the lead, and he claimed victory effectively with a stage to go, the coverage seemed to disappear. And even though he won, he was the first Briton to win the Italian tour, no one really cared, which was just strange because I thought it was an incredible achievement and he's an incredible cyclist.
We obviously talk about how his personality isn't exactly the most engaging with the British public, and the fact that there's the Kenya aspect and there's him and as a person. But I kind of think that perhaps the main issue right now is this perception of cycling, in that it's allegedly riddled with these drug allegations and these anti-doping cases. And I feel that the fact that there's so little trust in cycling is perhaps why there's now so little trust in someone like Chris Froome.
Well, the thing that doesn't help Froome, of course, is he's got this allegation hanging over his head, and it's been hanging over his head since September, so that's 9 months now, and it's still not being resolved, which is a joke. And actually, there were some developments last night. So we're recording on the Saturday, so on the Friday night, there were some developments in the Team Sky came out and said that the test used on Froome that found out his abnormal levels of the drug was an inaccurate one. It has like a 15.4% chance of coming back with incorrect results, which is statistically very, very bad. But then the UCI themselves turned around and said, but the study you've used, Team Sky, to prove that was done on dogs and not humans. So the debate rumbles on. I think his case is coming up quite soon, which is why Lizzie Danan came out and made these comments to, you know, actually try and say, look, we need to get behind Chris Froome. We need to support him. We need to trust him. The fact is this drug that he had in his system was a legal asthma drug, just had double the amount in his system, and this is only the only test throughout the entire Vuelta that came back negative. Every other test was fine. So obviously there was some sort of anomaly. We don't really know why, and that's what the whole hearing's about, but can we please just get on with it now and just remove this cloud that's hanging over his head and actually hopefully prove that he's a clean cyclist and that the sport of cycling isn't being championed and his best rider isn't a drug addict or even a druggie.
Well, imagine if he was a drug dealer. That came out
very wrong.
Well, I suppose there's the leak aspect as well, because it's still an ongoing case, and that kind of highlights to me a bit of a lack of professionalism in some way, that it has been leaked to the press many, many months ago now. And from a journalistic point of view, happy days, we love leaks, but in terms of the professionalism of the investigation, this already leads to many people making up their minds. And I think even if he is proved innocent, it's not going to get the same level of coverage as when it initially broke. And it might bypass a lot of people.
That's exactly what Danan is saying. He's been tainted. He's got that reputation of how people think about him now. And whatever happens with the result of this hearing, and for whatever he does with the rest of his career, he's always going to be remembered as having that accusation hanging over his head. And a lot of people down the line will sort of forget all the details and just remember Chris Froome as being a user of drugs when it comes to cycling. And that might not be the case, but that's how potentially it will be remembered. And that's really sad, considering, you know, just what he's done for the sport. One of his greatest rivals the other day, Vincenzo Nibali, just came out and said he rides like a superhuman. He says, how can you keep up with someone who's so good? But over in this country, that was barely covered, what Nibali had said. Whereas in other countries, you know, I think Froome is actually talked about in higher regard in other countries than he is in Britain, which is quite frankly ridiculous.
Sticking with the unprofessional aspect, and do Team Sky have to hold up their hands a bit here as well? Because I think you can portion a lot of the blame at their door with the way they handled the Bradley Wiggins affair and the TUEs and their mishandling, let's say, of keeping medical records and what was in jiffy bags and here and there. And I think it's something that you're going to mention with regards to Ollie Holt's piece in the Mail, is that it just adds to the preconception that it's a tainted sport because of what Team Sky have been doing recently.
Well, Oliver Holt, I've got it word for word here, on the eve of his Giro d'Italia win, he came out and said, Froome is competing in a sport still riddled with drug issues, riding for a team who've been discredited and taking part despite failing a drugs test last September. So what are we supposed to think when he rides a stage like Superman? And he makes a very valid point. So cycling for years and years and years, like for as long as I can remember, has just been riddled with drug accusations, and, you know, the greatest stars being accused and sometimes found guilty of taking drugs.
Lance Armstrong, key person in that, I feel.
Exactly.
So much hope was raised and it just got crushed.
And then, as you say, Team Sky have had all these issues over whether they are or not, they are or are not breaking the rules with TUEs and, you know, the jiffy bags and all that sort of thing. Froome himself has now said for so long he wasn't a drug user, and then he failed this test. Even though it was a legal drug, we must state it was a legal drug he took. It was just double the amount, allowed amount, for whatever reason. If that was the case, if the test wasn't flawed. So that's now hanging over his head. And then he comes back and does what he did at the Giro. You know, it was a fantastic comeback. If you look at the stats, if you actually look by the day-by-day breakthrough, how he came back to win that and beat Yates was phenomenal. But in the world we live in, and with all these things adding up, it just makes him... It helps enhance that negative reputation surrounding him. And as Dana says, it's unfair and it's not justified.
Exactly. In the age of social media, people can chat about it, rumours can spread. And the case with Chris Froome rumbles on. But we will move now into topic two, a very broad topic, by the way. And if somehow you've been living under a rock or in a remote desert somewhere, you can't have failed to notice that the 2018 FIFA World Cup kicked off in Russia on Thursday, complete with Robbie Williams and numerous meme-worthy images of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Following the opening ceremony, which was described by Totally Football Show host James Richardson as being as sparse an occasion as Donald Trump's inauguration, but also probably put on by the same people, the host nation promptly trounced a diabolical Saudi Arabian team 5-0 to get things up and running. I'm going to compose myself because I thought that comment was great. But we're not going to talk about that opening game. First off, we're going to talk Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi, with the former lighting up the tournament last night, as we alluded to in the intro, after he banged in a hat-trick for Portugal against Spain in that 3-3 draw. The free kick was amazing. The game was amazing. So, how do we assess Ronaldo versus Messi, which is a matchup that is always brought up every time there's a big tournament, be it club level or international level?
It's an intriguing debate, and for me, I think this could be the World Cup where the world finally decides who's better, personally, because Ronaldo's made such a good start now. He has a precedent that he's set himself that he needs to follow now for the rest of the World Cup in terms of carrying Portugal, because that's what he did last night. Portugal aren't the greatest of teams, but with Ronaldo, you know, in their side, as I think Danny Murphy said last night, you can never discount yourselves as if you're Portugal. And Messi, you know, he's also not single-handed. Well, no, he did single-handedly carry Argentina through the qualifying campaign. Despite they've got a better team, they've got greater firepower. He's the only player to score for Argentina in a competitive game since 2016 or something ridiculous.
Which,
like,
when you consider the attacking talent that country has at its disposal, is quite embarrassing.
But then, can Messi now lead Argentina to really where they should be, which is the World Cup final at the very least, if not winning it?
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting. I know Messi is also 3 years younger than Ronaldo as well. And that's the thing a lot of people forget, is that Ronaldo might, you know, turn around and say, oh, Ronaldo's got more goals and played more games, he's got more trophies. Well, actually, he doesn't have more trophies. Messi does. But Ronaldo has also been around longer, and Messi's still got a good few years of his career left.
Interesting segue that I was talking about last night with the family, watching Ronaldo play. He's 33 now, and I remembered however many years ago it was now, and Ronaldo and Rooney were the two up-and-coming players. Rooney is younger than Ronaldo. Where is Rooney now? So if ever there was a lesson in looking after your body, there is a perfect one. But interesting that you note about Ronaldo kind of being the figurehead and carrying the team, yet Portugal won the European Championships and Ronaldo went off in the final after about 15 minutes. Is he as important to Portugal as we think?
I think what Portugal have and what Portugal realise they have is they don't have the greatest talent to match up with the likes of Spain and Argentina and Brazil. But what they do have is this togetherness. Like, there's a real team mentality there when you watch them. Whereas whenever I watch Argentina, you do get the sense it's a bunch of individuals trying to play as a team. Whereas Portugal, there is a very strong team ethos. And Ronaldo seems to be like the leader of that, but he also seems to be encouraging it. So we saw Euro 2016, when he went off injured, he was still there rallying the team on, and they went and beat France, who are a better side. So there's definitely that. Whether it's he that brings them together, whether it's the coach, or whether it's just a whole mentality, I don't know. But It's just a very solid unit of players there. And at no point last night, when they were losing 3-2, did they let them, you know, they let their heads go down. There was a few nasty, niggly challenges come in, but that's because they were chasing the game and they were trying to win. And they actually, you know, they held stronger in the second half as a defensive unit. And they gave Ronaldo the option to go and do what he does best. So I just think that he is the leader, but underneath him, he's got a really good, strong core of a team. That whether that's down to him or not, we can't tell.
You kicked off this discussion about you thinking this is the tournament where we can finally determine who is the best out of both of them. Is it as simple as that, where if one of them has a World Cup victory to their name, that's the clear defining difference?
If they've played an integral part in that World Cup victory, i.e. they've led the team, scored most goals, you know, provided the key moments such as scoring an 85th minute equaliser with a free kick, having not scored in any of your last 45 attempts on goal with free kicks, then yes, I think you can. But that's just my opinion.
We will see how these weeks play out.
People will always argue Ronaldo versus Messi, Ronaldo versus Messi. We all have our individual preferences for whatever reason. But I think a World Cup victory next to your name, and if you've spearheaded your country to that victory, will make a difference in how people perceive you.
Because I think, well, people make that comparison with Messi and Maradona. Messi, Maradona, or who's got the World Cup victory to their name? It's Maradona. Same sort of argument.
Yeah.
But we will move on, sticking with the World Cup, and we're going to talk a little bit about the teams, the stories that we're looking forward to, I suppose, as the weeks unravel. Is there any particular highlight or team that you're most anticipating seeing?
Well, there was something I briefly flicked over this morning, and any Millwall fans will love me for saying this, but Tim Cahill.
Oh, gosh.
Comparing himself to Pele, like, overnight.
Did he?
He did.
My word.
I didn't read the full article, but I think it was more in terms of the number of tournament appearances he's made rather than the number of goals he scored. But at 38, you know, he's still going, and he's still Australia's talisman. You know, he was the reason they got past Syria to get through into the World Cup. You know, he scored all those goals, so it'd be great to see him finish on a high note, get a few more goals, get Australia through to the latter stages.
Go on, Tim Cahill. My perspective, I'm looking forward to Peru, partly because it's their first appearance at a World Cup finals in 36 years, but also just some of the stories about the fans going out to see them and taking part in all of this. There's been some rumours that fans have actually sold their homes to afford the travel to Russia, which probably should get your priorities right first, but still, that shows up the national fever that's surrounding this team at the moment. But arguably, my favourite story that I heard is the Peru fan who went and put on 25 kilograms because he heard there was an obesity eating competition going on in Russia, and he saw that as his opportunity to get out there. So he put on his 25 kilograms and he actually qualified. So that is determination and commitment to the cause, if ever there was one.
So backward, though. It really is.
What an effort, though. A round of applause for that man. Also looking forward to Senegal. I think they could actually be quite fun. And this is in no part due to the fact that I drew them in my office sweepstake.
Well, Senegal were in a really interesting group, aren't they? With Colombia, Japan, and Mexico. Is it Mexico?
I think so.
No, Colombia, Japan, and Poland. I can't remember.
I think, Poland.
Yeah, Colombia, Japan, Poland, and Senegal. And that's just, like, who do you pick from that group to go through?
Senegal. They've got some really exciting players.
Sadio Mane.
In particular. My man, West Ham's Cheku Kouyaté, who's captaining the team.
I wouldn't call him an exciting player. I'd call him a reliable, good player.
He's
but not
robust.
Exciting.
But even like in centre-back, they've got Koulibaly of Napoli and also Keita Balde up top in attack. So everyone's had a soft spot for Senegal since, I think, 2002 and what they did at that tournament.
Yeah, when they beat France.
Exactly. I think they'd be quite... If you're going to pick a team that will be the most fun team to watch and get involved with, probably Senegal.
Another West African team, though, that will run them close on that is Nigeria, who always bring a splash of colour.
Speaking of colour, how awesome is their kit?
Their kit is very good. But unfortunately, they found out the other day they won't be allowed to take live chickens into the stadium. So apparently it's a good luck tradition in Nigeria to take a live chicken into a football stadium. But the Russian authorities have banned it.
Which spoil is sports.
Just the animal rights records are very good in Russia. That's all I can say.
I won't say anything else on that. I could say a lot more. But anyway, to finish off World Cup chat, we will turn to England, of course, our country, and they kick off their tournament on Monday when they play Tunisia in their opening group game. It's a 7 p.m. kickoff that night. So how is your optimism, I suppose, looking at this group of players at this tournament?
Thing is, there's a lot of reason to be optimistic, but you don't want to allow yourself to be optimistic.
Been down that road before.
Thing is, Gareth Southgate here is really in a no-lose situation, which is good for him in that if England bomb out, people turn around and say, well, he's, you know, it's not his fault. They haven't got the players, you know, he hasn't been there very long, blah, blah, blah. And if they go and do well, he'll be the best thing since sliced bread. But the bunch of players we've got are good and talented and young and exciting.
I think I tweeted this out actually after the Nigeria game. They're not the most talented team we've ever had by any stretch of the margin. I mean, consider some of the players we have had down the line. But they are an instantly more likable team, I think, in terms of personalities. And I think as a group, they gel better.
And under Southgate, they actually play some good football. They're a fairly attractive team to watch now, whereas we all remember under Capello and Hodgson how stodgy it was.
Stodgy Hodgson.
You know, you crawl to 5-0 wins against Kazakhstan and beat San Marino 7-0, but my word, it was painful.
On the Gareth Southgate thing as well, he came into the job. I think a lot of people had this perception of him as an FA yes man and relatively stale and boring. But I'm very impressed with what he's done and how he's dealt with crises and just cast them aside. The Raheem Sterling thing with the gun tattoo. We could say many things
on that
story.
I thought it was a tattoo of Peter Crouch doing the robot.
Someone's been on Twitter. But the way he dealt with that so easily. He's an expert in crisis management, that guy. And also the way he's dealt with the Joe Hart issue, which could have reared its ugly head. Dealt with and all done and dusted. We're not talking about that anymore. The way the Rooney affair was dealt with. Retired, done and dusted. Don't have to deal with that anymore. Who's going to be your number one goalkeeper? Pickford versus Butland. Sorted, dealt with. Captain, sorted, dealt with. All these questions that could have posed a problem before the tournament started. And he's dealt with masterfully.
I think what he's done really well is he has endeared himself to the press. You know, he's given them opportunities. And
the England players were playing darts with the members of the press.
Yeah, I mean,
they
had that whole sort of... And the thing is, this isn't new in terms of so many other sports, so many other teams have been doing this for years. But for football and the England football team, this is very new, you know, this openness. But the press have really warmed to him and they aren't laying into him as much as, you know, if Roy Hodgson or Fabio Capello made those decisions. And Southgate is a modern manager. He understands the need to have the press on your side, for this, you know, with all the social media stuff and everything. He understands all of that, you know, how things can blow up. And he just goes and deals with these things in his own way, in a very calm fashion. And there's no really, like... The thing people are getting hit up the most at the moment is Glenn Hoddle's commentary, which is always fun to read on Twitter whenever he's commentating. The comments that come through is brilliant. But, like... There is no worry about England. It feels very relaxed, very calm. It doesn't feel like there's a lot of pressure on them. Obviously, then, this could all change on Monday with a poor performance against Tunisia. But for the moment, everything seems to be okay and seems to be optimistic. Like, no one has expectations of England getting beyond the quarterfinals, where they'll probably meet Germany or Brazil. But if we get that far, considering where England have been and come from, I think that'll be a success.
Considering the national team hasn't won a knockout game since 2006, to win a knockout game would probably be a step in the right direction.
Certainly so. Let's just hope it doesn't go to penalties.
Good old penalties.
Don't let Ashley Young take one.
On Ashley Young, before we finish up talking about England, we'll talk system and a little bit of tactics. Because I kind of like the three at the back system that's going on at the moment. But the only thing I would change is the personnel in the wing-back positions. Because I think at the moment he's playing Trippier. And Ashley Young, I think, is his preferred option at left wing-back. But I kind of only see that system working if you have a left-footed player there. And the only contender for that would be Danny Rose, who's been in and out of the Tottenham team. And I also think Kyle Walker should be at wing-back as well, whereas I know he's been playing sort of right of the centre-backs at the moment. Don't know if you agree with that.
Well, who are the other centre-back options? Because at the moment it seems like his preferred three are Walker, Stones and Maguire.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got Cahill as well. But
Phil Jones as well.
he's got a mistake in him. Okay. I don't think Southgate trusts him. I think if it was Smalling in the squad, I would say yes. I would have more faith in putting Walker at right back. But with Cahill and Jones as the backup centre backs, there's just that, you know, there's a mistake coming from both of them. And I think Southgate might realise that as well.
Okay, with that, I have written down my preferred 11 for the first game. Do you have one in your mind?
I can have one.
Who's in goal? Pickford.
See, I like Butland.
I think Pickford's in better form, and he also has the distribution aspect in his favour. My three at the back are Stones, Cahill and Maguire. I think Cahill's form is better towards the back end of the season.
I'd stick with Walker and go with Stones and Maguire. And I know Cahill has the experience, but I just wouldn't pick him for the moment.
So then I presume you're having a right wing back.
Kieran Trippier.
Trippier, whereas I'm having Walker. Left wing back, I'm having Danny Rose.
Probably on balance I'd go Rose, but I don't really mind because they're both good.
Good choice. Holding central midfield, I think it's pretty clear it's either Henderson or Dyer. I think Gareth Southgate said as much. For me, Henderson just edges it. Partly given, because of his leadership aspect.
Given that Henderson is a Liverpool player, I'm obviously going to pick him. He's also the England vice. So Henderson.
That's why I'm putting him not on ability, but more the leadership aspect. Ahead, I've got Lingard and Ali, sort of the more advanced. Because I think they look very good as a duo against Nigeria.
I think Lingard's a good player and in good form. And Ali had a good end of the season. So yeah, I wouldn't disagree.
And then Kane and Sterling.
So I'm going to go slightly rogue.
Oh, here's Kane, this is what I was counting
Kane
on.
And Rashford. So not massively
not entirely rogue.
It's not like Kane and Ashley Young. But yeah.
Anyway, we'll see what happens.
Also, Fabian Delph put in a very, very good shift in the warm-up game against Costa Rica. He could have earned himself a starting lineup place. It's looking unlikely, but he definitely gave the manager a headache.
Which is what it's all about. He needs headaches. But anyway, with that, that concludes this discussion section. But stick around because after the break, we have our full interview with sprinter Beth Dobbin, talking all things sport, working two jobs at the same time as competing, and also managing her epilepsy. So stay tuned after this.
Have you signed up to Banana Crumble? The free online cash prize giveaway. Sign up today at www.bananacrumble.co.uk for your chance to win. Sign up is quick, free and easy. Don't believe us? Hear what some of our winners have had to say.
Winning £50 with Banana Crumble was an amazing feeling. Being a student, it's often hard to get money, so I was able to put it straight towards my rent for second term.
Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Working alongside the Cystic Fibrosis Trust to raise vital funds for this fantastic cause.
Welcome back, everyone, to our latest feature interview section on the podcast. And our guest on this episode has been making waves recently after she broke a 34-year-old record at the start of this month. It is a very warm welcome to the show to Beth Dobbin. Beth, how are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
All good, thanks. And delighted that you can come on as well.
Thank you for having me.
We'd best start, I suppose, with the headline news, as it were, because on June the 2nd, you went and set a new Scottish 200-metre record when you ran 22.84 seconds to win the UK Women's League Premier Division match at Eton. And that time bettered Sandra Whittaker's 22.98 set time from the Los Angeles Olympics in 1984. A lot of detail for people to absorb there. So my first question is, when you cross that line and see your time, do you fully understand what you've just done?
So it was a weird one actually at Eton, because normally the clock is quite a bit back from the finish line, so you can see it as you cross it, whereas at Eton it's bang on the finish line, so you cross the line and you think, what have I just ran? So I walked back to the clock and the clock was blank, and all of my teammates were shouting at me, 22.86, 22.86, because that's what it stopped at, because often it can get rounded up or rounded down, and I just remember just shouting no, like that can't be. So I marched up to the officials box and be like, I was just like, what was the time, what was the wind? And they were telling me, and straight away I knew what I'd done, because I was very aware of the Scottish record. I think last season I went fifth on the all-time list, and that was a huge achievement. And I knew, obviously, of Sandra's record, and I was just like, oh my days, I've broken the Scottish record. And that was like, the first feeling was you've gone sub 23 by a significant amount, and then the second feeling was you've broken the Scottish record, like, wait till you tell your dad this.
Yeah, absolutely. And you say, oh my days, and I find that quite interesting that you have that Scottish record in your mind, because I suppose a lot of people might not even consider it. So did you set yourself that as a target to kind of reach?
I think I wanted to go sub 23. That was the target. But I knew that if I went sub 23, you know, that it was going to be a Scottish record as well, unless I went 22.99 or 22.98. And then, you know, then you're equaling it or just behind it. So I knew that if I went sub 23, it would be the case. And, you know, it's not been a target to do. I just wanted to win my races and run fast. But when I ran in Loughborough, I ran a 23.1 in Loughborough. Then I knew, like, the conditions weren't great. I knew that in good conditions on a good track, I could go sub 23. So the confidence was there.
Yeah. And obviously since then, you've spoken to Sandra as well, which is a handy video you can see on the BBC website. What was that like as well, just to talk to her about what she'd done and the record you've managed to beat?
Yeah, it was crazy, and she was so lovely about it, and she was so honest. She said she was upset, she felt emotional, because obviously it's her record, it stood for 34 years, but at the same time it's a very positive thing, because, you know, it shows Scottish sprinting is moving forward, and it is about, her words exactly were, it's about time, and it is about time. 34 years is just too long for a record to stand these days now, sprinting's evolving, so it is about time. But it was so lovely of Sandra, and she's really following me now. So after the Diamond League, she messaged me again and was like, you've lowered it even further. And I did say that to her. I said, I want to lower it even further. So she's watching out for my results now, which is great, because obviously growing up, you think, wow, like, I will never run them times. Like, you put these people on this pedestal, and then to be running the same times, it's a great feeling.
Exactly. And in the immediate future then, you kind of alluded to it there, is it about beating your own record and bettering yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't expect to do it in Stockholm. I thought, you know, I'd be quite tired. But then, yeah, to lower it again by a hundredth of a second. But I just think, you know, the way my coach writes our training programme, it's never to peak in May or early June. That isn't the case. It's to peak, you know, for the British trials and then whatever championships you go to after that. So our programme is designed. We've still got a bit of load in the programme at the moment, and that's going to come out these next couple of weeks, so that when I go to trials, I should be in the best shape so far. So I definitely think I can lower that further. And trials means so much to me. You know, I put a lot of pressure on myself in a good way to perform well there. And I think I do perform well under pressure. And hopefully it just brings out a good performance on the day.
Yeah, and the form is all the more incredible as well, because looking back to before the Commonwealth Games, and that was an event you missed qualification for by 1/100th of a second.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I've never been in that position, but I can imagine when you're in that position, it must be doubly painful to get so close but still not actually make it.
Yeah. Yeah, it was... the only way I could describe it is heartbreaking. You know, because I ran it... I ran the time at the start of July, so... I thought, oh, well, I've got 2 months to get it. I will get it. Like, I'll 100% get it. And it just didn't happen for whatever reason. I think trials took a lot more out of me than I realised. I probably wasn't in that kind of shape. It was more the adrenaline. So, it was devastating. And then you have in the back of your mind, well, I'm only 1/100th of a second off. There's no one else that's got the standard. Maybe they might still take me. I was very optimistic about it. And I might get a relay spot, all these kind of things, and none of it happened. So it was genuine. I just could describe it as heartbreak, and watching the other athletes out there, you know, it's big on social media these days. Everyone was posting, being at the Commonwealth. So I watched every single second of it on the TV. So it was really hard to take. And I just, like, made a promise, don't ever let that happen again. You know, every session I do at the moment, it's in the back of my mind. You know, I missed out by 1/100th of a second. That can't happen again. So it really has motivated me.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, has that really put a fire in your belly?
yeah, definitely. It, like I said, it's just, it's in the back of your mind that you've missed out by something that you couldn't, if you were holding a stopwatch, you couldn't stop it. You couldn't physically do it. It's the minutest amount ever. And it's just, you know, to miss out by that, it does hurt. But it just makes you think, you know, I need to do it again. And it's kind of motivated me because obviously being a Scottish athlete, I think the Commonwealth Games are extra important because if you get to represent Great Britain, it's great, an amazing achievement. But like to represent Scotland at a championships, it's like it only comes around once every 4 years. So, you know, I think it's really, really important for Scottish athletes. And it's, you know, it's made me think of 2022 and when they're going to be held in Birmingham, and I'm already thinking about that, and it's 4 years in the future, so it does really put a fire in your belly.
Exactly, yeah. And with the record breaking antics that you've had this month already, is this almost the perfect remedy for that heartbreak and really driving you on again?
Yeah, definitely. And especially from a Scottish perspective, because I look back and think, wow, I didn't even make the team, the Scotland team for the Commonwealth, and to now be the fastest ever Scottish woman, it's like not many people can say that. You know, we have great Scottish athletes, and not some of them don't even have like a Scottish record. So for me, it's just an amazing achievement. And like I lay in bed at night and think, oh my God, I've achieved that. Like it's something I'm really proud of.
From before the Commonwealth to now, is there anything you changed in terms of your training that's made you faster, or is it primarily a mental thing?
I think it's a combination of a few things. So I think I've been with my coach 6 years now, and I think every year there's been a progression, maybe not huge jumps, but there has been a progression every year. And I think I really believe in his training programme, and I think 6 years in one programme has done me a lot of good rather than swapping. So I think that's the first thing. I think we've had a strength and conditioning coach work with us this year. So that's the first time I've ever had that in the 6 years I've been in Loughborough. So that's been really useful because it's things like power cleans that are so important for sprinting that I was probably doing very wrong. Wasn't necessarily using my legs to get the weight up, and my strength and conditioning coach has taught me like how to do it properly, and I'm just lifting so much heavier in the gym. So I think that's the second reason. And I think the third reason has been the 400 meter session. So even though we've only done a few, I think I'm a strength based 200 meter athlete, so the strongest part is my finish. And that 400 metre work has worked on that finish. So my last 50 is quicker than it ever has been because we've been putting in that longer work. So I think it's a combination of a few things.
Mm-hmm. And obviously all this becomes even more impressive when you realise you don't have a sponsor and
yes.
You work essentially full time at Loughborough,
yes.
Loughborough Uni, in reception of the indoor track, I think, and also in security.
Yes.
Is that difficult to manage your time with training?
Oh, it's pretty brutal, to be fair. I mean, I'm lucky. I really do enjoy my job. And I think it's the people I'm around, the people I work with are really great. But it's what I struggle with is the lack of sleep. So a typical shift is 7 till 3. So if you start work at 7, you're up at 6, 6:30. Now, if you want 8 hours sleep, you've got to be asleep by 10. But athletes are recommended to get 10 hours sleep. And I don't think I could physically fall asleep at 8 o'clock at night because most of the time I am still at the track at that time. So we train at averagely about 4 o'clock when a few of us have finished work and lectures. So if I'm there 3-4 hours, I finish at 8 o'clock, I come home, I have something to eat, get ready for bed. You know, it's 10 o'clock by the time I'm in bed. So I think that's what I struggle with most, the lack of sleep, lack of recovery. And especially throughout the winter, I'm working 7 day weeks because throughout the summer I'm taking time off to train. So literally from October all the way through to April, I've been working Monday to Sunday, like no non-stop. I think I went 1 month where I didn't have one single day off because just trying to save up so that now obviously I'm flying to Switzerland first thing in the morning. I always give myself 2 days off work before a competition, so it's like that's 4 days off work that, you know, that equates, if you do 10 competitions a year, you know, you've taken a lot of time off work, so that's resulted in me working 7 days a week the rest of the year.
That's a schedule that I don't think anyone will envy, really.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's obviously the negative side of things, but are there positives as well that you can take from those jobs? Where, I suppose, does it keep you grounded, determined as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've always been a grafter. Since the age of 13, I've wanted to, you know, be independent, have my own money, babysat, sold programmes at the local football club. I've always had a job, and I still think even if I was to find funding, find sponsorship, I would still have to work because I'm so used to it. And it gets you into that routine of, you know, you don't mess around, you get to work on time, you get to the track on time, you just do everything so everything has to be spot on, because, you know, you can't slack off, you can't not cook your meals for the next day because you've got a full day at work, so you are on it. And in that hard work ethic that's been driven into me for so many years, you can transfer that onto the track. And there's also a sense of, you know, I'm putting myself through this, I need to make it worth it on the track. So, you know, I'm getting up at 6:30 every day. I'm not doing that for fun, like, I'm doing that to have a good season. So there's that as well, you're putting yourself through that.
Yeah. Are you one of those people then that almost needs to be doing something constantly? Because if you have a day off, or, you know, several hours of where there's nothing on, you kind of wonder what to do.
I never used to be. I always used to dream of the, you know, the full-time athlete life where I could stay in bed till training and, you know, chill out and everything's so relaxed. But this year I started this new job last June, so I've been doing it about a year now. And since I've done that, I have found that, you know, on the odd days off, because I do enjoy it, I'm like, right, what do I do with myself? And I think because the odd days off are so rare, you don't really know what to do because you don't have that free time. So when you do, you're just like, I've got other stuff to do, like washing, ironing, all that sort of boring stuff that you often neglect because you're so busy. So even though you do have days off, you've still got stuff to do. But going, like, taking time off, it probably is something that I wouldn't say that's my personality, but it is something that I would struggle with probably now because I'm not used to it.
And I mean, going back as well, you graduated from Loughborough Uni in July 2016 with a 2-1 in psychology, and then started a graduate job.
Yes.
I think, was it helping children with autism in some way? But
yes.
Handed in your notice after that.
Yes.
Why was that time so particularly challenging?
So I did really enjoy the job. It was very, very, very rewarding, but it was a sense of, it was very stressful as well. So I was leaving the house at 7 to get to work for 8. I spent like a bit of time travelling there when I was based further away, and then there 8 till 4. I was leaving the work at 4 to get to the track for 5, and then I was at the track from 5 till like 8, 9 at night. And then you've got to come home, you've got to cook your meals for the next day, you've got to get your 8 hours sleep, which never happened. And the job itself, although I absolutely loved it, it was really rewarding. I was just having to think all the time, and I was having to work hard. So then when I got to training, I was like, I just want to lay down. I don't want to think, because I've been on it all day. Whereas my job at the moment, it isn't very challenging. It's literally just behind the reception, not doing too much at all. But then when I go to training, I can, you know, give everything to my training. And so I made the decision. It was basically because I thought, oh, maybe, you know, maybe I'll go to the Commonwealth, and it was based in schools. You know, I'm going to have to take a lot of time off. And I was getting opportunities, you know, to race midweek that I was having to turn down because I couldn't get the time off work in the school. And I thought, I'm you know, I'm in Loughborough for my athletics. I'm away from my family for my athletics. I need to put it first, and I need a job that fits around that a bit more. I do also go into schools as well. So on Thursdays, I do school visits. So I do, that's my day off training typically, where I do two school visits. So I do that as well.
So did it just become mentally draining, essentially?
Yeah, that's what the last year's job especially became. It was mentally draining, and it was quite physical as well. The children obviously had autism, and some of them could be aggressive, and, you know, I've always been an athlete first. That is all what I see myself as. So if I'm like restraining a child or being kicked or anything like that, I'm thinking, oh God, I've got a big session tonight. My coach is going to kill me if I can't do it because I've been kicked, and things like that that you wouldn't necessarily think of until you actually did the job. And I think it is definitely something I would want to pick up once I've retired from athletics, but I just I didn't think it went hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever a point of view then where you thought you might have to choose between the two? And was there ever a part of you that thought, leave aside the athletics if this job is so rewarding?
No, I think my athletics has always come first. I love it more than anything. It is my passion. And I'm a big athletics fan as well. I just love the sport. So for me, although I did enjoy the job, it was nothing in comparison to how much I love athletics. And as well, if it was up to me, I would move back home with my family. But I'm in Loughborough to train, so I wouldn't want my career job to be in Loughborough anyway. So for me, Loughborough isn't a long term thing. I do want to move back home once I'm done with my athletics.
So this is the part where we kind of turn back the clock a little bit and find out how you got into sport. Obviously, a sport you love so much. So how did you first get into it, and who are the influences for you?
Yeah, so my dad was actually a professional footballer. He retired quite late in his career, so I just remember him doing all sorts in his bedroom, like press-ups, loads of just circuits in his bedroom. And I remember watching him thinking, that looks quite fun, you know, I should give that a go. And then I must have been about 8 when we started going out for runs together. He'd retired at this time, but he was keeping up with his fitness. And we'd go for like maybe 3 miles runs when I was really, really young. So I did get into athletics because of that, the long distance side of it. And then I was probably in year 5, 6 at school, started doing cross countries. My dad took me down to the local athletics club. Then I realised how it works is when you're younger, they just throw you in all the events to see what you can do. And I actually found out I was actually quicker than I realised, and you know, I'd beat the boys in PE, things like that. So I joined the local athletics club, it just went from there, really. That's how it started. I did have quite a bit of time off when I was younger. I was quite poorly, so I took quite a lot of my early teens off and got them back into athletics. I was probably 17, 18 when I got back into it, it's taken off from there, really.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And obviously you mentioned your dad there, Jim, and there's your mum, Jean, as well. How much of an influence do they play in your athletics career?
They are wicked. Honestly, I couldn't do it without them. They're so supportive. They love it as well. And you know, they sacrifice a lot, I think, because my mum, she I know she really misses me. I know she would love to have me at home and see me all the time. And it's things like Christmas. You know, you go home Christmas Eve and you're back to Loughborough Christmas, Boxing Day, and I think she struggles with that, not seeing me so much. So for her, when I do well, it's like it makes all that worth it. And then my dad, he just loves it as well. They're both so supportive. They come and watch me race when they can. Whenever they can come and watch, they'll be at trials, and they're just so supportive, so understanding. And even before I had this success, they never once, you know, said to me, oh, you know, do something proper with your life, get a proper job. They've always been so supportive that, you know, this is what I want to do. And I remember the first time I broke 24 seconds and my family were like screaming with joy, and it's like, now look how far we've come. They just support me so much.
Mm-hmm. It must help as well when you go through your tough times that someone like your dad has had that experience as well, coming from a professional sport. So do you bounce off each other when that happens?
Yeah, I mean, he's really good. Like, you know, he knows what to say before a race, in terms of like encouragement, things like that. So yeah, he's definitely experienced that. And you know, at the moment, I'm thinking about different agents to go to, and he can offer me advice on that. And you know, he's got the experience there. And like, I remember he's such a hard worker. So when we used to go out for runs, it'd be like, no, don't stop. You can't stop till we get home. So he's just taught me that, you know, keep going attitude, and these things like, you must make sure you stretch, things like that. But at the same time, they're not overly pushy at all. When I feel it's only because I want to do it that they want me to do it. You know, if I think they'd be disappointed if I decided not to do it anymore, but they would never try and force me into it. And I remember, like, my mum and dad, they never really used to come down to watch me train when other parents were there. They just didn't push it at all. And now I'm still in the sport because I feel like if they'd pushed me into it, I'd have been like, well, I don't want to do it because you want to me to do it. And you know, so they at the same time, they're not overly pushy at all.
Exactly. Yeah. So moving on to epilepsy, which is something we've never talked about on this show before, but it's something you have.
Yes.
How is that to manage? Because I gather it's pretty much under control now.
Yes, so I had my first seizure I had two seizures at school, early teens, so I was about 13, 14. And my second seizure was actually a very, very big one. So it took my speech, it took my memory, it took the movement from my left side. It was so severe that they actually thought it was a stroke. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot to come back from that. And I did have a lot of time off athletics. But the most... the thing that affected me the most was the medication. So they put me on some medication that made me tired. Yeah, they put me on medication that made me really drowsy. So I would sleep for, I'd get in, I'd go to bed at like 8, not wake up till 8 the next day. And before training, I still tried to do my athletics. I'd always have to sleep. I was just so tired. And I remember my mum saying to me, when you come off your medication, you're going to notice such a difference. And I remember Di Green, he's a Welsh athlete, and he has epilepsy. And I read an article that he'd, an interview that he'd done. And it was basically he approached the doctors saying, I want to come off my medication because my athletics isn't going very well. And I've researched this. If I live this kind of lifestyle, I can control my seizures. That inspired me to do a similar thing. The doctors wanted me to come off my medication as well. I did that. And since then, it has been difficult because when you've got that medication, you kind of know you're not going to have a seizure. And there was a point a few years ago where I was really struggling mentally because I was just paranoid I was going to have a seizure. That was probably the hardest side of it. But touch wood, at the moment, it's all under control. Everything's fine. You do still have moments like after Eton, when I ran, I felt dreadful. I had to go down and lie down. Whether that is epilepsy related, I don't know, or whether my blood sugar's just dropped, I don't know. But I just had to lie down for a bit. Didn't feel too good. And it was about 2 hours before that passed. So there's always that in the back of your mind, is that still something that is, affecting me? But I just try and look at it really positively to think, you went through all this and you've came out the other side of it.
Exactly. And hearing you talk about that massive seizure as well, there must be a part of you that was really terrified that your athletics might be taken away from you through no fault of your own.
I think at the time when it happened, I actually thought, I remember panicking, thinking, this is it, you're going to die. Because it was just so huge. I think I was out for like 15 minutes. And I remember just going down and seeing my friend's face, my best friend now, actually, her face, I can still picture what it looked like. And it looked very worried. So it's like little things like that. But I think more the mental side of it, when I think, I start to worry that, you could have another seizure and that will ruin your athletics because, you'll have to go back on your medication and then your medication didn't work for your last time for your athletics. So, it would ruin everything for me. So I think that's why I worry about it so much. And that's why I'm so careful. I try and stay on top of everything, lead a good lifestyle, eat healthy, because I wouldn't want to put myself in a position which could result in a seizure. I wouldn't be able to do my athletics anymore. So that's why it's like really important to me.
When you go through something like that, does that almost change your outlook on life a little bit, where it's kind of live each day to the fullest? Because I, going back to Chevron Clark, the boxer who was on this podcast, and he had two near-death experiences, if you like.
Yeah.
And that's what he says happened to him, and that his kind of whole outlook on life almost changed after that.
Yeah. I think it does, but probably not in the way you would think. So, like, live your life to the fullest. I think it's had the opposite to me. I'm not a risk taker at all. Like, I really value my life. So I would never, do a bungee jump because I think that rope could snap and, I've had a near-death experience already. I don't want another one kind of thing. So it's made me really sensible. And, like, things like a lot of my friends went to uni and, started taking recreational drugs. And I just could never get my head around it because I'd be like, you're putting your life at risk. Like, some people have had to fight for their lives and things like that. So it makes you definitely value life. And when, you're walking down the street, and you think, oh, some people aren't taking care of themselves. Like, I would always, even if I wasn't doing athletics, I'd always eat healthy, look after myself, you know, not drink too much, because I just think you do get one life, and so if you live it in a certain way, it can ruin your life. And there's some people out there fighting for their lives. So I think it's made me more sensible, if anything. I'm definitely not a risk taker. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. So when you're putting it back to the back of your mind, is that a hard thing to train yourself to do?
Yeah, definitely. And especially a few years ago when I was really struggling with it, it is hard to forget about. But I think athletics is a real, you know, way out for me. So when I go to the track, you know, I'm that's all I'm thinking about. I'm not worried about anything else. I think it has helped me massively. And you know, especially on race day, you're that nervous and you're that worried about your race that you don't have time to think about anything else or worry about anything else. So it is a big distraction from it, even though sometimes, yeah, it can cause anxious feelings, because you are worried you're gonna do yourself, you know, if you have a seizure, it's going to have a bad effect on your athletics. So it is a bit of both, but it definitely is a release.
Yeah, because, I mean, you hear the effect sport can have on someone with, say, mental health, for example, and how it's almost a release and a focus on something else for them. And it sounds like it's very much the same kind of thing with you.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's really important to, you know, have something that you can, like, devote your life to, whether it's your job or your family or just a passion that you've got. I think it's so important to feel like, you know, I've got a purpose. This is what I enjoy in life. And whatever it is that you enjoy in life, I think it's really important that you do. Like, it will help you mentally and physically.
Yeah, absolutely. Something you've already touched on earlier on was speaking in schools. Speaking on illness, speaking on medication, overcoming injury, things like that. Mm-hmm. Why was it important for you to sort of branch out into that line of work?
Yeah, so I just thought that my story might not be one that's, you know, I've achieved Olympic gold medals and all these different things, but it is one of, you know, not giving up and determination. And I think the children in schools, when they don't really understand the magnitude of certain medals and you know, certain championships, I think it's much more important to hear something that they can maybe relate to, something that they've seen someone go through where they haven't got what they've wanted the first time or the second time, and then they've not given up and, you know, achieved their goals. So when I go in and in the assemblies, you know, I tell them my story. I say about the setbacks and other setbacks I've had with the sport, with injuries, and, you know, missing out on the Commonwealths, missing out on World Indoors, all these setbacks I've had, but I'm still doing it now, and look what I've achieved this year. And if I'd have given up each time, I wouldn't have achieved this. And we do, like, games and circuits with them, and you say, you know, like, when you were doing the circuits today, you didn't give up, and you try and teach them that perseverance. And I say, you know, it might be relatable to your schoolwork, so you might not get your A star the first time, but it's important to keep persisting, be resilient, and you will, if you put the work in, you will get the results. So I think they take a lot away from that, and I've had, like, good feedback from the teachers, and then you take in your medals as well, and you tell them your achievements as well, but I think they relate a lot more to, you know, a story about hard work and setbacks and not giving up.
The messages and the stories you put across, are those messages you needed to hear when you were that age as well? Or did you hear them?
I don't think I did hear them, but I definitely, going back to my dad, I definitely saw, you know, how hard he worked, not just with sport, but in every aspect of his life. You know, he gives everything, all he's got, and I think that's so important. And he used to tell me stories about when he was younger, and how, you know, his family didn't have much, and he'd go out and sell newspapers to different pubs. And, you know, he was working from a very, very young age, and he drilled that into me that you have to work hard. So I think I did have it a bit from my dad, and my mum would tell me stories from my nana and granddad about what they went through. So I did have that. But I remember being at school. Well, now I can look back, being at school, we never really had anything like that happen in our school, and that would have been a dream come true for me, for an athlete to come in, you know, do some sport with me and tell me about their story. I would have loved that, but we never had that at my school, and I think, like, the teachers tell me the kids have been excited about this all week. It's such a huge deal for them. And you know, you get like letters after that they've still remembered it, and that's why you do it, so they can, you know, take something away. And school's hard these days, you know, they've got so many exams that they've got to do, and it can really dishearten you. But if you just think, no, you know, I mean, they probably all don't all take something away, but if they can think, you know, I might not have done what I want this time, but I can work harder and get it the next time, and that's the aim of it, really.
Exactly. And from your own personal point of view as well, to know that you might have helped even just one or two children in the class you were talking to, that must be a very rewarding thing as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I do two schools in one day when I do it on my day off, and it's typically the older ones, the year six, that you can, when you're speaking in assembly, you can tell you've really got their attention, and they're quite shocked because you're going in and you're not talking about fancy things that they're probably expecting, so they are taken aback by it. And yeah, like you said, if you just help one child per school, you've made a huge difference, because then they can go on and, you know, they can help one person, and it's kind of just like an effect like that.
Exactly. And before we wrap up this interview, we'll bring it back to athletics and back to sprinting, and sort of talk about what's next in line for you, because there's talk of the 400 meters, and obviously you're off to Switzerland tomorrow as well. So what is kind of next up in the immediate future?
So the next big one is the British Trials. So that's on the 1st of July, and that's where I'll be competing to make the team for the European Championships in August. So I need to finish top two there to qualify for the Europeans. And the 200 is really stacked this year. There's a lot of us with the standard, and we're all just, you know, hundredths of a second between each other. So it is going to be really, really close. So that's like my next main aim. Obviously, I wanted that this season was supposed to be my last season at 200s. I'm feeling a bit like I'm going to change my mind about that because how well it's gone. So I feel like the way I feel at the moment is I want to, you know, start doing 400s definitely in terms of relay, because I think as a sprinter between 1 and 4, you know, if you're 1 and 2 runner, you can go down to the 4x1, whereas if you're a 2 and 4 runner, you have to step up to the 4x4. So I definitely want to be a part of the relays, because, you know, athletics is an individual sport. You don't get much to do with teams, so relays is really important for that. So I feel like the way I feel at the moment is I want to still keep in touch with the twos next year, and maybe it will be a slower transition than rather than just, right, I'm moving to 400s next year, that's that. I think it will be, you know, maybe I can get my time lower next year, who knows, and I might hit a brick wall and think, you know what, I've maxed out my speed, let's move to the fours. But I definitely think it will be twos and fours next year rather than just fours.
Exactly, yeah. Do you set yourself a long-term target, if you like, or a long-term goal, or is it very much kind of seeing where you're at the moment, seeing where your times are at, and then play it by ear kind of thing?
You do set yourself long-term goals, but they do change the more success you have. So my long-term goal was, you know, to always make the Commonwealths, and I would love to make the Olympics relay 4x400 team. But then when you look at the success you've had and you think, do you know what, I can start making teams as an individual event and do the relay. So it does change depending on how it goes. And as well, this time next year, I might be saying something completely different. Athletics is a brutal sport. It just takes one injury and it can knock you back so much. So touch wood, I'm not, but I could be saying something different next year. And then that changes your goals. But I think every athlete has the aim of making it to the big championships, and for me this year it's the Europeans, hopefully next year it's the Worlds, and following that it's the Olympics and the Commonwealths, and that would be like a dream come true for me, really.
Exactly, yeah. And with that, we should probably wrap up this interview, and we really hope that dream does effectively come true, and we wish you all the very best in that journey, and also all the very best when the trials come around at the start of July.
Thank you.
I'll finish off by saying thank you once again for taking some time
out
and chatting to us on the podcast. So all the best, and enjoy Switzerland when you leave.
Thank you. I'm sure I will. Thank you.
Thanks so much to Beth for coming on to our podcast, and I hope everyone enjoyed that interview. I certainly enjoyed it myself. Before we go, as ever, we'll point people in the direction of our social media pages. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And of course, you can always email us feedback and other stuff. Our email address is sportspielpod@gmail.com. Another thing I should probably mention, the 52 blog has reared its head on social media recently. Fortunately, the person behind that is sitting opposite me.
Hello.
So, want to give us a little taster of what's to come?
So, the 52 blog, 52 weeks, 52 blog posts, just to try and increase the visibility of women's sport to the point where it's the same as the men's. So, 52 stories I'll be telling, one a week, for the next year, and I've already had some brilliant people come forward to me with stories they want being told, so that's a fantastic start. By the time this podcast has been released, the first 52 members will have been announced. So make sure you have a look at the _52 blog on Twitter for more information. And if anyone ever has anyone they want to nominate for the 52, then just send me an email at editor@the52blog.co.uk.
Hope everyone's got a pen to write these down after this.
So much social media loving.
Yes. On the subject of loving, we're going to finish this off with a little bit of podcast love. So we're going to point you to a podcast we think you should listen to because we like them and we would highly recommend them. The one I'm recommending this week is Ed Knowles and the Olympic Channel podcast. So Ed and the team get listeners to delve into the mind of Olympians by bringing us engaging interviews with some of the best stars around. Carl Lewis has been on. The last one I listened to was David Price, which was actually a really interesting one about how he's battled back from being hyped up as this next big thing, and it hasn't really turned out the way he expected. Now, on June 20th, so that's this upcoming Wednesday, it is Olympic Day, and the guest on their podcast for that is swimmer Yusra Mardini, who was a member of the Refugee Olympic team at the 2016 Olympics. That is sure to be a very emotional but also quite engaging and interesting interview, that one. So I'm actually quite looking forward to that. Now, sure to be a cracking listen, and if you like us because of our interviews, then I'm pretty sure you'll like that podcast as well. So like Sportspiel, then go and follow the Olympic Channel podcast as well. That is everything from me. Don't know if you have anything to add before we wrap up this episode in its entirety.
No, just big thanks to Beth for coming on and being our guest, and big kudos to you as well, because she only broke that record literally 2 weeks ago and you managed to get her on the show in the very quick turnaround time, so well done.
Oh, thank you.
Pod love.
Yeah, that, all about the pod love. And with that, we will send out some last pod love to you, the listeners. Have fun, everyone, until we come back in 2 weeks' time.